Royal Albert Hall.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. I'm starting this 117th season of the BBC Proms in probably the best spot in the Royal Albert Hall, with the Prommers, who have been queuing for 24 hours plus to secure their place at the very front of the arena. They could, if they felt so inclined, lean forward and have a whispered conversation with the violinists of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. When we get to the second part of the concert, this front line of Prommers will be just a few feet from where the soloists will be intoning the high drama of Janáček's Glagolitic Mass. Before that, a young man who turned 19 just a few weeks ago, Benjamin Grosvenor, will perform Liszt's second piano concerto, launching a season-long celebration of the composer and virtuoso born in 1811. Benjamin Grosvenor is still a student at the Royal Academy of Music, and it was with students in mind that Brahms wrote his academic festival overture, which Jerzy Bielechlawek, chief conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, will direct. After what promises to be a spectacular and loud start to the concert, courtesy of Judith Weir, full use made of trumpet, organ, timpani and chorus in Stars, Night, Music and Light, a setting of a brief extract of a 17th century poem by George Herbert. So what should be an energetic and, I think, high-octane start to the Proms, the orchestra just beginning to tune, and I'm going to grab a very quick word with a couple of Prommers right on the very front rail here. Are you a regular, madam, at the Proms?
Yes, I've been coming for the past 30 years.
30 years?
Yes.
How do you get so close to the front? Is it very competitive?
I get here very early in the morning.
So what time are you here today?
11 o'clock.
Why do you keep coming back?
I love being with all my friends and great music. Simple as that.
Let's talk to the gentleman next to you. Are you a veteran of 30 years or more?
No, only 15, 16 years.
Bad.
It's not too bad, yep.
What are you looking forward to most this year in the Proms?
It's the difference of the music. We all come to standard performance of standard works, but it's the ability to learn, hear new pieces, and the wide range of music that they have.
Here we are looking up from the very front of the Royal Albert Hall, this vast space. It's a glorious place for music making, isn't it?
It certainly is. As I say, there's been a lot of that over the last, for me, only the 15 years, but there's an atmosphere, it's like no other.
Thank you both very much indeed. I'm going to get out of your way because we're just awaiting Stephen Bryant, who is the leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, who's going to take his place on the platform. Here he comes. We open, as I say, with the world premiere of a BBC commission, music by Judith Weir, Stars, Night, Music and Light. The stars have us to bed, night draws the curtain, which the sun withdraws, music and light attend our head. Silence briefly falls in the Royal Albert Hall, that moment of anticipation before the start of the 117th season of Henry Wood Proms. Jerzy Bielechlawek makes his way centre stage to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra, BBC Symphony Chorus, BBC Singers in Stars, Night, Music and Light by Judith Weir.
Thank you.
Music and light, the essence, says Judith Weir, of what the Proms brings us every year in 2 months of continuously illuminating performances. Stars, Night, Music and Light by Judith Weir, world premiere of a BBC commission opening this 2011 Prom season. And next, it's Brahms, so you may not have heard it before, the Academic Festival Overture. Jerzy Bialochlawek conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the BBC Symphony Chorus and the BBC Singers in Brahms' Academic Festival Overture. And I wonder if you have heard it like that before. That's an arrangement by Malcolm Sargent, so associated with the Proms, of course, including the student song Gaudeamus Igitur, Let Us Rejoice, with a last line added by Sargent himself, Long Live Music Colleges. Well, Benjamin Grosvenor, who we're going to see on the stage in just a couple of minutes' time, is still at Music College. Having heard Brahms, we're going to move on to his contemporary Franz Liszt. Born 200 years ago, his music-making taking a prominent position in this year's Proms season. We'll hear his Faust and Dante symphonies, Mazeppa, Totentanz, and the Mephisto Waltz No. 1. At the last night of the Proms, Lang Lang will play his first piano concerto. We're going to start the season with the second, played by Grosvenor, who won BBC Young Musician at the tender age of 11. Now in his third year at the Royal Academy of Music, he celebrated his 19th birthday just 8 days ago. Earlier, I asked Benjamin if this was a good choice of concerto for his Proms debut.
It's a piece I wanted to play for a long time, so to be able to do so for the first time professionally at the first night of the Proms is very exciting for me.
I think you played it with an amateur orchestra.
I played it with an amateur orchestra in Southend, yes, which was extremely helpful. Otherwise, I'd be performing it for the first time here, which would be very scary indeed.
So that was about getting the experience of playing it live, I guess.
It was, yeah, and it was a nice concert. It was in my hometown. It was actually at my old school, so a lot of people I knew there, and it was a lot of fun.
Now, you've rehearsed it at the BBC's Maida Vale Studios, but I guess it was getting into the Royal Albert Hall for the first time that was quite a major part of this. I mean, getting used to that enormous space, I suppose.
It is an enormous space. It reminds me, actually, when I was rehearsing by myself earlier, it reminds me of concerts I've done outside, because the sound just goes up and away. It sounds quite dry on stage, and of course in the hall it sounds completely different. And so playing in such a big space causes a lot of problems with projection, especially when you have the big large force of the orchestra behind you really carrying and getting the sound out there is difficult.
And is that something you've been able to have useful conversations with Jerzy Bielachlawek about?
Yeah, it's my teachers here and some friends as well, so they've been around the hall in different positions, and the conductor's been very helpful with that issue as well.
The relationship in this concerto between the orchestra and the pianist is very important, isn't it? Because it's not like the first concerto where it's this enormous kind of virtuoso thing. There's much more integration between the two.
Well, the first concerto, the piano writing is quite flamboyant, and this one, the piano is very often integrated with the orchestra, or it is merely accompanying solo instruments. For example, the most beautiful moment is probably when the cello comes in and the piano there is merely accompanying that instrument as it plays its solo.
So there's a real relationship between you and the orchestra?
Yes, I mean, in some ways it's like a huge piece of chamber music in the way that it's written and in the interchanges that occur.
What does Liszt mean to you? How do you think of him as a pianist composer?
You know, from his piano writing and from all the comments from his students and from how his students played, you know that Liszt was himself an extraordinarily great pianist. In terms of his music, it's my initial love was Chopin. And, of course, getting to know Chopin and his style of writing, there's a lot of similarities between Liszt, and so naturally I became very interested in Liszt as well. And he's certainly one of my favourite composers, I think.
And he features on your new disc about to be released. This is a big time for you, isn't it, with this Proms concert, the new disc. Lots happening.
Yeah, the last few months have been very busy, kind of been non-stop. And I recorded my CD and then I had a lot of concerts while concurrent to editing the thing. So that took up a lot of my time. And then I've been preparing for the Proms, and of course I've got two of them, and both concertos I hadn't performed before, so I've been learning them from scratch for the event. But what a great thing to do. I'm glad I'm doing it. Well, my whole family's going to be here, and everyone's told me what a wonderful receptive audience the Proms audience is, and so I'm really looking forward to it.
Benjamin Grosvenor, what an experience for him, making his Proms debut on this first night of the season. Speaking to him actually yesterday, just after he'd rehearsed the concerto for the first time here in the Royal Albert Hall, he sensibly decided to keep a very low profile today, so he's absolutely focused and ready for tonight's performance. bbc.co.uk/proms is the place to go, by the way, if you want to read detailed programme notes for tonight's concert. Any of our concerts are coming up over the next 8 weeks. You'll find programme notes, texts, etc. there. bbc.co.uk/proms. So the hall anticipates the arrival of Benjamin Grosvenor. Here he comes, wearing an open-necked grey shirt. Jerzy Bielachlawek, conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, behind him. This Proms performance of Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 2. 19-year-old Benjamin Grosvenor making his debut at the BBC Proms, playing Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 2 in A. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Wielechlawek. Ben Grosvenor, the youngest of five brothers, began playing the piano at the age of six. And he's a member of BBC Radio 3's New Generation Artist Scheme. NGA performers spread liberally across the season, this 117th BBC Proms. Here he comes back onto the platform with Jerzy Wielechlawek, who looks a bit like a proud father escorting his son. Grosvenor stands alone now at the front of the stage. Clutching a red handkerchief in his hand. The whole BBC Symphony Orchestra stand now. This is really very touching. He looks sort of bashful, excited, slightly anxious, but delighted as well. Took Liszt a huge amount of time to finish both his first and second piano concertos, quarter of a century in the case of the first, 18 years for the second. Perhaps because of his inexperience in writing for orchestra, perhaps because of his busy life as a touring virtuoso, maybe, as Gerard Lana writes in tonight's programme, because of his ambition to rescue the concerto from the long-cherished three-movement convention and radically reform it, which he certainly did in the work we've just heard. Ben Grosvenor back on stage again. And he's sitting down again at the keyboard. Thank you. Benjamin Grosvenor playing as his encore Brahms, Hungarian dance number 5. I happen to know in an arrangement by the Hungarian virtuoso pianist Zsozs Cifra, who Grosvenor is a huge fan of, very famous for his performances of Liszt. He loves pianists from an earlier age. He told The Guardian last week that he sees himself as competing with the dead guys. His heroes are Cifra, Rosenthal, Korto, Shorochakovsky, Masurvich. Horowitz, he cites as his absolute favourite. He talks about Mozart, played by Lily Krauss, Schnabel's Beethoven. Benjamin Grosvenor back on the stage once again, a night surely he will never forget, making his proms debut to an absolutely packed Royal Albert Hall. So we reach the end of part one of this first night of the 2011 proms, live on BBC Radio 3. The BBC Symphony Orchestra's Czech music director Jerzy Bielachlavek will be on home ground in the second part of tonight's concert with the performance of Janáček's Glagolitic Mass, marking the start of a rich season of great choral masterpieces here at the Royal Albert Hall. But while the audience here try to remember which bar gets a gin and tonic out most quickly and where the friendliest ice cream vendor is, on Radio 3 we're going to hear more about the Glagolitic Mass. Janáček famously was a man who didn't do religion. What then prompted him to create one of the world's great religious works of art? The writer Paul Allen sets out to answer that question. Paul has recently incorporated Janáček's letters to his muse Kamila Stoslova into a dramatic monologue, and with readings from some of those intimate letters he explores the contradictory nature of Janáček's beliefs.
The old chestnut runs something like this. Can you fully appreciate art made in the great religious tradition and to the glory of God if you are not yourself a believer? The answer is usually along party lines. Atheists think you can, believers think you can't, and agnostics aren't really sure. Tonight, my question is, how far can you be expected to create a great religious work if you don't share the faith that it celebrates? What did Janáček need to believe in order to compose one of the most intense and passionate pieces of religious music ever written? Even his long-suffering wife never got to the bottom of that.
My husband's relationship to God was not at all clear to me. He never stood in the way of my religious duties, but he never took part in them himself. However, he had required that our children should pray. He never observed Friday fasting, saying that he'd fasted quite enough as a chorister, but he observed the fast on Christmas Eve and Good Friday. I never saw him pray. We never spoke about religious things. I was frightened that again I'd touch a dissonant chord.
A reviewer of the first performance of the Glagolitic Mass struck a dissonant chord, all right. Dr. Ludwig Kundera, father of the famous novelist Milan Kundera, wrote that the old man had at last made his peace with God and become pious. Kundera was a student of Janáček's, and he got a thunderous postcard in response. 6 words in the Czech language, a little more in translation. Not an old man, not a believer, youngster. In 1927, when the work was premiered, Janáček was in fact 74 and would be dead within a year. But with his long pursuit of Kamila Stoslova, a married woman almost 40 years younger, at last showing signs of bearing fruit, he was in no mood to call himself old. Religion is supposedly about the forgetting of self in face of the magnitude of God. But with Janáček, it seems to me, as much is revealed about what made him tick in the Glagolitic Mass as in any other work. Professor John Tyrrell is his biographer and the doyen of Janáček studies.
He certainly believed in himself. He needed to in order just to keep going. By the age of 60, however, it was clear to him that he hadn't made it. The First World War had been declared. There'd been stalemate over the operas. The rate of writing works had reduced almost to one a year. He was physically not very well. It did really look like the end. And I think at that stage he probably did think, well, I'm 60, I will have a quiet life, my material circumstances aren't too bad, and how different it all turned out to be. Ах, один Бог, но ты думаешь. I think there are about three different things which makes the change. Firstly, it needed the success of his opera Jenufa in Prague. That was done a couple of years later. It was, I think, a political decision to do it then rather than anything else. It was equally a political decision to do it in Vienna shortly after that. So suddenly he was wanted, and that made a difference. A second difference was that the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the creation of Czechoslovakia. He was a true patriot all his life, so this was very thrilling, and he wrote several works which commemorated that. Camilla was like a little afterthought in all this. She came along and transformed his life and gave him something to live for. I don't think she quite realised what she let herself in for, bombarded with letters every day from him.
You, darling Camilla, I know you're like a child which God created in the happy dream of his creation. As if you didn't even belong to this world, from which you wanted to jump off and fly unbound until you fell again into the arms of God. Maybe he would ask you, were you happy, my child? At least for a moment. You would say, yes, I was. And I thank you for creating me. And in reverie, I would also turn to the Lord God and would say to him, you didn't forget me. Even I was happy for a moment of my life. Now, take both of us. Perhaps the world no longer exists for us. We want to be in the actual presence of God's love.
She was a distant muse who comes into the works in strange ways. When he wants to write gentle music, he thinks of Camilla and Out It Comes, that sort of thing. So I think she's one of the reasons why he changed.
Janáček credited Camilla with inspiring Katya Kabanova and, of course, the intimate letter string quartet, among other works. He even associates her with the Tatar boy, Lelya, left in a Siberian prison at the close of From the House of the Dead, his last opera. She could hardly inspire the mass, however, because she was Jewish. Janáček was a declared unbeliever who then moderated his position with the words, "Until I see for myself," a marginally stronger version of the Doubting Thomas position, you might say. So why write the mass? He was a complex man, and there were at least four strands in his mental process, I think. Religion was part of it.
You must remember that Janáček's life was entirely dominated by the Catholic Church. He was baptised a Catholic. His father was the local organist, so he went to church from a young age. And then at the age of 11, he became a chorister at the Augustinian monastery in Brno, where he would have sung even more church services. And that's not the end of it at all, because when his voice broke and when his teacher, who was the organist at the Augustinian monastery, when he went off, Janáček became his replacement. So I think until about the age of 30-something, he would officiate in that church there. And furthermore, he founded something called an organ school. And that organ school, though Janáček liked to think of it as perhaps a conservatory, it was in fact something to train church musicians, organists and choir masters. And because it was supported by the Catholic Church, there were church people on the board. He knew many priests. He knew many dignitaries there. So he was associated with the church for all his life, really.
And once you learn the language of the church, you never really forget it or completely lose its way of thinking. But the Janáček who put small animals into his concertino and made the cunning little vixen not just a heroine but an emblem of the endless continuity of nature also learned early, and also never forgot, his relationship with the woods and hills and streams of the remote Moravia village where he was born. So he often gets described as a pantheist.
It's a description. I think it comes principally from his opera, The Cunning Little Vixen. I wouldn't have thought there was much evidence for it, apart, I suppose, from the Glagolitic Mass, when he wrote a famous article which was published in the local newspaper, which came at the time of its premiere, where he did try to place the Mass outside a church and put it into the forests of Lohatchovice.
The balmy breeze of the woods was always incense to me. The church grew for me into the gigantic size of a mountain, and the sky vaulted into the misty distance. The bells that rang were those of a herd of sheep. In the tenor solo, I hear a high priest. In the soprano, a girl, an angel. In the chorus, our folk. The candles are the tall pines in the forest, lit by the stars, and somewhere in the ceremony, I see the princely vision of St. Wenceslas.
Luhachovica was the spa where he originally met Kamila, but he was on his own there and missing her, sulking about it, when he composed the Mass. When he wrote to her about it later, it was strangely transformed into a nuptial.
But now, into that cathedral, two people enter. They walk ceremonially, as if along the highway, all a carpet, a green lawn. And these two want to be married. And it's strange that all their time there are just these two. So, priest comes at last. Nightingales, thrushes, ducks, geese make music. For their general now wants to marry that little negress, that small, tender, that dear Kamila. End of dream. You're already sleeping, and I daydream about you. Yours forever, L.
Now, I think that is purely something to charm Kamila, not something that he is to be taken too seriously, but it's very nice.
But the notion of the forest providing the cathedral is quite...
He didn't go into churches very often if he could help it, so he seeks his God elsewhere. Mm. So, OK, pantheistic nature, that sort of thing.
The forest, the faith, and his late love affair united in his imagination. But there's much more. That mention of Wenceslas or Václav, the holy monarch on whom Czech identity is so focused, reminds us that Janáček was also an ardent nationalist.
I wanted to show faith in the certainty of the nation, not on a religious basis, but on a moral one, a basis of strength that takes God as its witness.
Hence the Glagolitic Mass, by far the best of a number of Glagolitic Masses written as the Czechs emerged from the loathed Austro-Hungarian Empire. Glagol, the word, derives from the voice or tongue, but Glagolitic is the name of the script invented by missionary monks Cyril and Methodius for the language known as Old or Church Slavonic, one of very few licensed for occasional usage by the Roman Catholic Church, whose Masses were otherwise in Latin. Like many Czechs, Janáček looked to Russia and the Slavs for cultural, aesthetic and even vaguely political inspiration. But the Russian Orthodox Church and its settings of the Divine Liturgy would never have worked for him. Tchaikovsky, for example, whom he admired, respected the Orthodox insistence that the liturgy be unaccompanied and essentially contemplative. Compare these moods for the Gloria or Slava. Tchaikovsky, then Janáček. But on top of his roots, there's, from my point of view as a writer, something even more important about Janáček's creative personality. Now emerging as perhaps the greatest 20th century composer of opera, he thinks like a dramatist. This Mass is not for use in church, but for performance, as a dramatic cantata, a form, John Tyrrell has pointed out, Janáček used at three distinct points in his life, always with some connection to religion. It's most obviously dramatic in its response to mood, to atmosphere. Listen to the way Janáček suggests the Mass was originally inspired by an encounter with the Archbishop of Moravia amid the gathering gloom of a village ceremony.
Where did you compose it? The rain keeps pouring down. From your window, you look at the sullen mountain. The clouds roll. The gale tears them apart, scatters them. just as it did a month ago there in front of the Hochwalde school. We stood there in the rain, and next to me, a high-placed church dignitary. The dusk gets thicker and thicker. Now you look out into the already dark night. The lightning crisscrosses it. On the high ceiling, you switch on the flickering electric light. And you sketch nothing else but the quiet motif of a desperate mind on the words, Gospodi, pomilu, Lord, have mercy.
Well, he was certainly dramatising in that article. It's even set out like dialogue on the page. He didn't actually start composing until long after standing next to the Archbishop. Conflict is hard to work into a mass, but Janáček does dramatise, more significantly, by telling the story through profound contrasts and different voices, priest, angel and common Moravian folk. It's characterised. Listen to the creed and the passion with which he sets Christ's passion. The heavens being torn asunder at the moment of crucifixion. Listen for the timpani. And then to the way in which the line about belief in the Catholic Church is not sung by the chorus, but by the solo tenor. It's a heroic moment, but could that be Janáček's way of saying, I am moved by the passion, but it's the priest who believes in the church? There can be no very clear definition of Janáček's beliefs, even on the existence of the soul. He's sometimes adamant that it doesn't exist, but at others prepared to look into his own. For evangelists of belief or disbelief, his position will sound like intellectual laziness or even cowardice. I'd prefer to think of it as imaginative energy. His niece, Vera Janáčková, had a clear account of what he didn't like about religious practice.
He never went to funerals or cemeteries. He wanted to hear nothing of the dead and rarely spoke of them. In the old days, he would visit churches for atmosphere, preferably a monastery in Prague. But in later years, I could not get him into a church, even to shelter from the rain. A church, he told me, is concentrated death. Graves below the flagstones, bones at the altars, pictures all about martyrdom and dying. Pews, prayers, hymns, death and death again. I don't want to have anything to do with all that.
With no great hope of an afterlife, he couldn't glorify death.
Today, they are lifting the bells into the tower. It would be nice if they weren't calling people to bamboozling.
He pinned his faith in life and didn't want it to end. He also had a passion for passion itself, whether the passion of human love or the suffering of Christ. I don't think, incidentally, it mattered all that much whether Kamila really loved him or not. The excitement of her saying so, just once, was enough. And it's said that when she finally came to stay with him, with her small boy, he kept her awake all night, not with lovemaking, but by thumping his harmonium as he composed. To live was to work.
He was a very disciplined man. There was no doubt about that. He had a rigid work routine. He worked according to various deadlines. He worked incredibly hard, incredibly fast, and then had a few days off and then started all over again. No, he must have had a very strong belief in himself, although he doesn't enunciate it the whole time, saying, I'm a great composer and no one believes that. He just did it.
And when a dramatist is at work, his characters are as real as the ordinary mortals who surround him. So in one sense at least, God was real for Janáček. In his biography, John Tyrrell points out that Janáček thought of himself as a prisoner for much of his life. A prisoner of poverty, He'd once had to practice Bach organ pieces on a keyboard drawn in chalk on a table. A prisoner of marriage, only occasionally happy. And, of course, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire until 1918. In relation to his marriage and his passion for Kamila, he used to write that he needed freedom of feeling. Composing gave him freedom, and feeling is everywhere in his mature work. Terse, intense, personal, too personal for institutional Christianity, perhaps, and very beautiful, the music always following the natural melody he found in Czech speech. The Mass is the work of a man who questioned the existence of the soul, but was preoccupied with a sense of the spiritual, perhaps more animistic than pantheist. It's triumphant music, a celebration of life, but human life or divine? His last great piece was the opera From the House of the Dead. Into Dostoevsky's stories of imprisonment in the most extreme and subhuman conditions, he introduced a positive role for a priest. And on his score, he wrote an epigraph, the only time he ever did this, and it was a quotation from the novel itself.
In every human being, a divine spark.
Music from Janáček's opera From the House of the Dead, concluding that exploration of the Czech composer's beliefs and what led him to write his Glagolitic Mass, which we're going to hear in a couple of minutes' time. It was written and presented by Paul Allen. The readers were Elaine Claxton, Peter Polycarpou and Susie Riddle. Janáček's Beliefs was produced by Julian May. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall and the first night of the BBC Proms 2011. Wonderful sight in front of me of tightly packed rows of promers, and then looking out the more reflective atmosphere high up in the gallery above us. A wonderful musical community gathered once again. And what a brilliant opening weekend. We've got Antonio Pappano conducting Rossini's opera William Tell tomorrow night, an organ recital by Stephen Farr on Sunday afternoon, and the eagerly awaited and very rare performance of Havergal Brian's Gothic Symphony on Sunday evening. Benjamin Grosvenor, by the way, just taken a seat, couple of rows in front of me, surrounded by his family, and looking quietly pleased with his performance of the Liszt in part one of our concert. Well, right now we're ready for the BBC Symphony Chorus, BBC Singers and four soloists to join the BBC Symphony Orchestra in the Glagolitic Mass, conducted by Jerzy Bielochlávek. I asked him why he wanted to bring this particular work to the Proms.
It's a piece I wanted to play for a long time.
It is so beautiful. Why is it beautiful? Because it's wonderfully written. It is full of emotion, because the piece has enormous energy in it, which is unleashed with very rare courage to use the extreme combinations. For instance, three piccolos, three trombones playing together the chords, accompanied with three sets of timpani. So that's just one very obvious moment. Or the use of choir, which is, it's so passionate and it has such a strong influence on the listener, you know. And that's, I think this is a very typical situation for Janáček. His works never let you cold. You are always touched somehow, positively or negatively. It depends. But definitely it's one of the most original composer of 20th century, and for us, for Czech people.
Jerzy Bielochlávek, very proud of his Czech musical heritage. We've seen him conduct so many great Czech works with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. One of the most amazing facts about the Glagolitic Mass was that it was written by a non-believer. As we heard from Paul Allen in the interval, though he'd been a student of the Augustinian monastery in Brno, Janáček proclaimed he wouldn't even go into a church to avoid the rain. He saw the work as being much more nationalistic than religious. It was a true Slavonic work, he said. marking the mission of Saints Cyril and Methodius to convert Moravia in 862, Glagolitic, the early form of the Cyrillic alphabet that they used to spread the word. It's also work that proclaims his adoration for Kamila Stoslova, the woman he loved, even if it was an affair that existed in his mind rather than in reality. In this work, he said, "I tried to depict the tale that when Christ was crucified on the cross, the heavens were rent. Well, now I do the noise and lightning flashes, but what if in heaven, in the portal, Kamila were to appear? I would portray that," he said, "even better." Priest comes, Janáček wrote, "Nightingales, thrushes, ducks, geese make music, for their general wants to marry that dark girl, that small, tender, that dear Kamila." End of dream. "You are already sleeping," Janáček wrote, "and I daydream about you." Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra now tuned and rising up behind the great mass forces of the BBC Symphony Chorus, augmented this evening by BBC singers, an international cast of soloists to come on stage from Germany, from Russia, and two from the Czech Republic. We're going to be hearing the soprano Kibla Gerzmová, Dagmar Petzková, mezzo-soprano Stefan Finke, tenor, and Jan Martinik, bass. Glagolitic Mass, one of Janáček's last works, suggested by the Archbishop of Moravia after he'd unveiled a plaque to Janáček in his home village of Hochwaldy. So here are the soloists: Kibla Gerzmová, Dagmar Petzková, Stefan Finke, and Jan Martinik. Joining the BBC singers, BBC Symphony Chorus, BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Bielochlávek. Janáček's Glagolitic Mass, live on the opening night of the BBC Proms 2011.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh,
Janáček's Glagolitic Mass. BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Bielochlávek, BBC Singers, BBC Symphony Chorus, David Good, playing the mighty Royal Albert Hall organ, and soloists Kibla Giesmava, soprano, Dagmar Petskova, mezzo, tenor Stefan Finke, and bass Jan Martinik. Well, if that's inspired you to listen to more of the rich sound world of Janáček, the Symphonietta, performed by the Halle Orchestra and Mark Elder here at the Proms next Thursday night. That last movement so drawing its resources from the earlier work of Janáček. He added the organ allegro and that orchestral coda in September of 1927. That's the version of the Glagolitic Mass that we heard this evening. It started out as a work written the previous summer, a wet summer, which kept Janáček at home and kept him composing. The work first heard in a convalescence home in the village where he was holidaying. Filled with sick people, the music played on the chapel harmonium, Janáček himself declaiming the vocal parts in a hoarse baritone. Unlike tonight's great soloists and chorus, the BBC Symphony Chorus, their chorus master Stephen Jackson on stage at the moment, bringing his forces to their feet, augmented tonight by the BBC Singers. BBC Singers, real backbone of the Proms. 8 concerts this year, including 3 Proms Saturday matinees. Abauno from the soloists. Kibla Giesmava, Moscow-trained singer, sang Mimi at Covent Garden last season. This year made debuts at the Met and Bavarian State Opera. Dagmar Petskova, Czech mezzo-soprano, has worked closely with Jerzy Bielochlávek, singing much Mahler this season. Stefan Finke, German tenor, soon to perform Siegfried in Ring Cycles in London and Seattle. And Jan Martinik, winner of the Song Prize 2 years ago at BBC Cardiff, Singer of the World. Czech bass, who's a member now of the company of the Komische Oper in Berlin. David Good, international concert career, as well as being organist and head of keyboard at Eton College, taking his bows from the keyboard of the Royal Albert Hall organ. Well, we're back here at the Proms tomorrow night with Michele Pertuzzi and Matthew Rose amongst the cast of Rossini's William Tell, the orchestra and chorus of the Academy of Santa Cecilia Rome, conducted by Antonio Papano. Sean Rafferty will be sitting in this box to introduce that tomorrow night at 6:30. Soloists now back on the platform. Rapturous applause from all around this building. How exciting it is to be back in the Royal Albert Hall once again. This great circular space, the arena filled with the enthusiasm of the Prommers, and rows of seats leading up to what, 3 tiers of velvet clad boxes, more seats, and then those wonderfully lit arches above the gallery Prommers, the acoustic domes providing a ceiling to this temple of music. Jerzy Bielochlávek will return later in the season. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, of course, as with all the BBC's performing group, such an integral part of this great festival. BBC Symphony Chorus on their feet again. The Proms continue. They're here for the next 8 weeks here on BBC Radio 3. For now, with the sound of the applause of the first night of the Proms ringing in our ears, good night from the Royal Albert Hall, and back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrock, thank you, Petrock Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall. Wasn't it marvellous to hear the Glagolitic Mass from that new edition based on the original version of Janáček's score, a labour of love by the sound of it, and the performance too. Well, just to say there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom on Monday afternoon at 2:00 here on BBC Radio 3, and before it on Monday afternoon.
The BBC Proms Chamber Music Series. Over the course of the Proms season, from now until the 5th of September, every Monday lunchtime, Radio 3 heads to London's Cadogan Hall for chamber music of all shapes and sizes. A stellar cast of instrumentalists includes Yo-Yo Ma, Christian Tetzlaff, and Les Talents Lyriques. And our season begins with Bach's Goldberg Variations, one of the peaks of the repertoire, performed by harpsichordist Mahan Esfahani. Chamber music at the BBC Proms, live Monday lunchtimes at 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And with tomorrow night's Rossini opera from the Proms in mind, in a little over 25 minutes tonight, in Radio 3's Cabaret of the Word, the Verb, Ian McMillan reminds us about Radio 3's poetry competition, and by way of encouragement, lets us hear his own contribution, a poem inspired by Rossini's William Tell. To enter the competition, listeners are invited to write a poem based on a piece of music from this year's prom concerts. So how about a poem inspired by Janáček's Glagolitic Mass? It's certainly an inspiring, life-affirming piece, isn't it? Life-changing even. Anyway, this week's edition of The Verb is at 10 o'clock tonight. We're staying with Janáček. This is one of his male voice choruses, not perhaps a familiar sight to him outside Czech lands, unless you know his last opera, From the House of the Dead. Janáček, though, is probably familiar as a fervent nationalist, and this chorus, called simply the Czech Legion, was written in a matter of a couple of weeks in early November 1918, immediately after the Czech nation officially freed itself from centuries of foreign domination. Janáček more or less set himself up as an artistic spokesman for the resurrected national life of the country, and this chorus is effectively a hymn of gratitude to those who died for the cause of freedom. The singers at the premiere early in 1920 are the same choir, same in name anyway, as sing on this 1970 recording of it, the Moravian Teachers Choir. But even if you didn't know that, there's something about this singing, the style, the understanding of the idiom, which just declaims authenticity at you. Much of it a fascinating mix of singing and singing speech.
Náš věrný
The Czech Legion by Janáček, music written to honour those who'd made the sacrifice to bring about the creation of Czechoslovakia in October 1918. Must be incredibly challenging to sing that, but seeming to hold no terrors for the performers there. The Moravian Teachers' Choir, conducted by Antonín Tučapský, a recording from 1970. One more Janáček chorus from them to follow it, this from 1922, and as extraordinary as anything from Janáček's second youth, so to speak. The Wandering Madman is a ballad about a harmless lunatic who spends his whole life searching for a stone, the Philosopher's Stone, which turns base metals into gold. One day he meets a country boy, sung here by a solo soprano, who asks the madman how he comes to have a gold chain round his neck. The madman suddenly remembers the chain was of iron, so he must at some stage have come into contact with the magical stone, held it in his hand, and only to throw it away. And he spends the rest of his days trying in vain to find it again. Rather touchingly, it seems, words from the wandering madman were inscribed on Janáček's tombstone.
Thank you.
the Moravian Teachers' Choir, conducted in 1970 by Antonín Tuchapsky in one of Janáček's male voice choruses, The Wandering Madman. Well, to follow that here on Radio 3, Poulenc's Elegy for Horn and Piano, music first heard on the 17th of February 1958 on the third programme, the network that eventually became the one you're listening to now. Poulenc wrote quite a few elegies of one kind or another in his later years, most of them for departed friends, though he didn't always call them elegies. This one was in memory of the great British horn player Dennis Brain, who died in a car crash in the summer of 1957. The horn player here, André Cazalet, with pianist Pascal Roger. Thank you. A sense of peace, if only just, emerging from those final bars of Poulenc's Elegy for Horn and Piano, the elegy written in 1957 in memory of horn player Dennis Brain, and played there by André Cazalet with pianist Pascal Roger. This is BBC Radio 3. It's a little after 10 o'clock, and time now for our weekly visit to The Verb. Here's Ian McMillan.
Welcome to the last Verb of the current season, and we're feeling a bit end-of-termish in the studio, I can tell you. We're not doing any hard work. We've just brought along a few games while I tidy up my cupboards and try and persuade Philip Dodd to take his hamster home. Of course, being The Verb, these are Verby games. We'll be playing the game of identity with the Native American comedian Chukwuebillah Billy, the unwritten language game with the poets James Davis and Carol Watts, the game of love with the great Irish playwright Billy Roach, and a game that I call That's the Way to Peel an Apple. Rossini's overture to his opera William Tell, performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and conducted by Lamberto Gardelli. Everybody knows that part of it, but the opera itself is rarely heard. It's on Radio 3 tomorrow as part of the Proms, nearly 200 years after it was first written. And we're going to be talking about the opera with the music critic Susan Hitch. And then we'll think about how you might write a poem inspired by it and then enter that poem in the Verb's Proms Poetry Competition. And maybe I'll write a poem myself about William Tell as a sort of test piece, a template, a control in a Petri dish. So maybe we will do some hard work on this last day of term after all. And let's begin with the unmade, the unwritten, the unredrafted, the discarded, the abandoned. James Davis is a poet and literary activist based in Manchester. He runs the If P Then Q Press and helps to organise the Other Room Poetry Nights in that rainy city. His own work is concerned with the possibilities of language, as all poetry should be, of course, but some poetry rarely is. And I've got to say that as soon as I saw his new book, I wanted to get him on the show. The first half of Plants consists of poems that are, as James says, deleted or untyped or rejected or simply not written. So, James, let's hear a few of these pieces to start with, because that's easier than me trying to describe them.
Apples. Written, typed, altered, deleted. 15th July, 05. Booty, which refers to an old lady's slipper. Conceived, 7th May. Written, 7th May. Considered, 7th May. Rejected, 9th May. Bottle Bank, which is a bottle bank in Spain. Written, 30th of July, 2006.
Fantastic. Now, for the listener at home, James, who hasn't seen these poems, there's the title, then a couple of lines of the unmade poem, then almost a full page of white space, so the look of the poem is important.
Yeah. They come in a sequence of 31 poems, and the poems that are in the sequence are poems where a sensation was wanted to be kept. There are obviously poems which have gone in the bin, lots of poems which have gone in the bin, but there was a sensation in these poems that I wanted to keep them. So there was something wrong with these poems in terms of the form or the content, but in some ways I wanted to convey the message, but also didn't want to convey the message. So there's a kind of paradox at work.
So the process here then, so for example, Apples, which was Apples, written, typed, altered, deleted. That genuinely happened then? You wrote a poem which you deleted? Or are you playing with the audiences and the listeners and the readers' expectations there?
There's a mixture throughout the whole collection, but in Apples that's genuine. All the dates are genuine. Mm. In Apples there are many, many versions of Apples, many, many drafts, which I haven't looked at for a long, long time. Some of them have gone off the word processor, some of them are stored in files. So in something like Apples, there are a lot of ghosts there. So as you've pointed out, there's a title, one or two lines to describe a deletion, and a lot of white space. But underneath that, there are many, many ghosts. That isn't the case for all the poems, but in that particular one, there are ghosts underneath the poem.
These other poems that have gone in the bin, that you haven't, that you've just thrown away, They've not made it then to unmade status in that way. They've just been thrown away rather than ending up in the book as unmade poems.
Yeah, there's a sensation to these 31 poems where they're really important, but at the same time, I wasn't able to convey that sense in these 31 poems.
Good. So we're also joined round the unfinished verb table by the poet and academic Carol Watts, who featured in the recent anthology of radical landscape poetry, The Ground Aslant, that we talked about on the programme. So, Carol, is James writing then in an unmade tradition here, do you think?
I think so. I mean, it's difficult to get across how funny these poems are. They are hilarious. Yeah. But that unmade tradition, I think, is a bit of a riff, really, on the idea of ready-mades in some ways. And that then would link it back into conceptual art practice, where you take, like Duchamp, a urinal and you put it in a museum. Mm. In the same way that you take these poems, and they are really anti-poems in a way, that make you think about what it is to write poems, what the concept of writing poetry is, or what it is to make them, the process, the idea behind them, rather than the actual poem itself. I mean, for me, it links back into a conceptual tradition of writing poetry. It might link also to Tristram Shandy or a funny anti-novel, where you've got a whole novel that goes on about the impossibility of writing a novel.
Yeah. That really interests me, because so often the deleted poem is seen as a failure.
Right.
And yet James is celebrating the unwrittenness. Is that how it feels to you?
Yeah, it's almost like a continual series of failures, if I could put it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one that you read about the booty, which is, it's got this wonderful sense of comic timing where you conceived 7th of May, you can kind of see the poem beginning to take place, you know, written 7th of May, but you never get to see it. Considered 7th of May, so you're having kind of afterthought about what that poem might be, and then rejected 9th of May. So it's as if each poem thinks about the failure of writing poetry, which is really the way that poems work in a way. I mean, I think it opens that up to a reader.
And even within the unmade, you're writing within a formal framework, because there are three unwritten sonnets here, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. There are.
Let's hear those unwritten sonnets, and then we'll talk about them.
The first one's called Sonnet. Various lines deleted on forgotten dates, 2005-6. Final line deleted 30th of July 2006. The second one's got a kind of juvenile title. Kill your fellow employee, dismiss the link between this, that and the other with a grand employer. 14 line poem started 2001, abandoned mid 2003. Its final sonnet in this sequence is in iambic pentameter. Sonnet. 13 lines dumped, 14th July 06.
They do make you laugh. They are fantastically funny. Sometimes the title leads up the garden path. So three sausages, open brackets, and a parsnip, close brackets. That's funny. And they're meant to make us laugh, aren't they, James? We are meant to celebrate them with laughter and joy and glee.
Yeah, they're absurd. All poetry should be fun.
Yes.
Yeah, all poetry should be fun. Yep.
And Carol, James is playing with the expectations of the reader, though, in a comic way, isn't it? It's that when you see the titled sonnet, you kind of expect a sonnet, and then when you don't get one, the reader's expectations have been toyed with, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, as a reader, you're kind of wondering what zone you're in when you get into these poems. You're wondering where the poem takes place. And actually, there's a sneaking suspicion that you might really be faking it. I mean, that there may not be a poem there at all. Or in fact, the poem may never have been written. And so you begin to wonder whether you're hallucinating with these poems. I mean, is there a poem here or not? And in some ways, it opens up for the reader the world of the process of writing poetry. I think it does that very powerfully. But then once you're trying to work out, well, what is the relationship between, you know, Cod Farm and having a conversation with Paul on a particular date? We don't know whether the conversation ever took place. So we wonder whether the poet's actually really there at all. Is there a poet in this text?
There are three methods. So I've talked about the unwritten, so where there is a huge amount of text underneath and there are ghosts. But then there are poems which were not written, i.e. that there was a thought that took place, but I would never put pen to paper. And then there are conceits which come towards the end, which were really not even thought about. And what I've tried to do as I've gone along is forget which of those processes took place, and I don't ever look at the files again.
But it's interesting that as a reader, I feel invited in. I really feel as though I'm invited in to complete, and then in many ways actually write the poem for you. When I see the title and I see the unwritten and I think, that reminds me when I come out of the post office.
in the way that the best poetry does. Even in these couple of lines, it makes you want to come in and play with the poem, doesn't it? Carol, it becomes a playful space, doesn't it?
It does, and actually you can begin to hear all of the poetic traditions or poems you might like coming through your own ear. I mean, like there's one here, The Longest Days Are Those Spent at Sea, which has got this amazing romantic title. You're into a sort of romantic zone of where poetry might take you. And then it says underneath, not written for Laura. Mm. And 3:21 in the afternoon, 24th of March, 2007. So you're in this banal, everyday world. But it is the world that poetry comes from. I mean, that is the place where, if you like, romantic poems take place. So I think you do hear other kinds of poems coming through the airwaves, as it were.
Well, in that particular poem, what attracted me to that very much was the precise time, the 3:21 in the afternoon. Isn't there a Tom Raworth poem that's set at a precise time?
Yeah, there's a sequence.
That's right.
So from Moving Images,
I think. So it's a particular time. And then at 3:21 in the afternoon, when you read the poem, it's a kind of magical alchemy occurs. And that one was part of a sequence of love poems. So perhaps you could, we've heard that one, The Longest Day, so perhaps you could read the one on page 31 for us.
Sina, which is a name given to Danish females, some Danish females. A poem for love. Attempted again, 3rd of the 12th, 06.
See, to me, the bit that stands out for me there that's really a heart puller is when you go again. Attempted again. I just love that. That is a real... There's a quality of love. I know it's about love, not for love, but just the idea of, with a love poem, with love, you attempt again. And it's just that word again leaps out at me.
Yeah. I think love poetry, it's the idea of love is perhaps even more powerful than an individual love, how to write about love in general. It's to write the poem, isn't it? The important poem about love is something that a lot of poets attempt, and I'm still attempting and fail at doing.
So, Carol, I mean, you teach writing, and I wonder if this would be a thing you could try with the students, this idea of the unwritten poem, the unfinished, the deleted poem.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a long tradition of thinking about poems that erase themselves. But what I really love about these, I mean, there are two things really. One is that they make you think about the technology of how you write poems. And actually, most of us now write poems onto screens. Mm. So there is this deletion moment, and yet it's deeply effective as well. I mean, the emotion is there, and yet the machine is there at the same time. So I think it's a great exercise, actually, to try and have poems that are taken away in the same gesture. I mean, that may have taken place, you know, because in a way you want as a reader to hear more and to invest more when you hear those. So I think it's a great exercise, actually. But it's more than an exercise.
Yes, it is. Let's finish with, I'll give the title, then you can as well, because then we can celebrate the title. Let's finish with Gecko's Redone from Memory, 30th of July, 2006.
Gecko's Redone from Memory, 30th July 2006.
Many thanks to James Davis and Carol Watts. James Davis's book Plants is published by Reality Street Press. Here on The Verb, we're always interested in language as a way of defining who we are and who we can become. Chuckaway Billy is a member of the Lakota Sioux tribes who, by a convoluted route involving pen pals and open mic nights, has ended up, as he says, the only Native American stand-up in the UK. So, Billy, our mic is open.
Hello, Halito Chima Chukma. I'm Chuckaway Billy.